if you're totally embedded in a culture of racism, you can't see it. It's like the air you breathe. You have to ask to find out if you're a racist. Today, the questions. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Healing Racism has brought Tim Wise to Alaska. He's here to engage with you. Our number, toll-free, 1-800-478-8255-478-TALK. Email talk at aprn.org. Tim Wise talks about being colorblind or not on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Tim Wise is author of White Like Me. He's been brought to Anchorage by Healing Racism. And so that means some people think there's some racism here to heal. I think we've seen some sobering incidents, largely involving the way Alaska Natives are treated. He's here to help out as best he can. He wrote a book entitled White Like Me. Tim, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And the way you kind of put it is, I can say things in these books that people of color might not feel they can say.
Well, I mean, they're things that people of color certainly do say and have said for a long time. Most of the teachers that I had growing up and the mentors that I had in the anti-racist struggle were almost all people of color. But one of the things that folks of color began to say 40-some-odd years ago, coming out of the civil rights struggle in the South, folks in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, et cetera, whose 50th anniversary we celebrate this year, were telling white folks by 67, 68, that our obligation was to work with our folks and to educate other white folks about racism and how it affects people of color, because they, as people of color, might have a harder time getting through. You know, just like men need to challenge other men around sexism, because lots of times women have a hard time getting through precisely because of sexism. So I try to be an ally and act in solidarity with folks of color, talking about the same things that they talk about, but trying to discuss them in a way that in the case of White Like Me, talks about my own experiences, both with issues of prejudice and racism internally, but also issues of privilege and unearned advantage, and really talking about what that means for a society that proclaims itself one of equal opportunity, but often doesn't live up to that.
White privilege. Huh.
Yeah.
That's kind of the stuff that's like the air you breathe.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's like any other form. And I know it's a term that lots of folks get defensive about, particularly those of us, you know, who didn't grow up with money. I certainly didn't. So I didn't have class privilege. And when we think of privilege, that's what we think about. We think about money. But there are other forms. There's able-bodied privilege. There's male privilege. There's straight privilege. All of those things. And when you have it, you don't think about it. That's the point. You don't have to think about the fact that you have advantages throughout the day. As an able-bodied male, for example, I'm able to come into buildings and not really think about where the steps are or is there a ramp. And that's able-bodied privilege. That's the ability to have one less thing to sweat. For those of us who are white, it's similar. We're not worried about being racially profiled by police. We're not worried about trying to get a loan from a bank and having our race be a tip-off to the loan officer that we might not be creditworthy. We may not be creditworthy and we may not get the loan, but we don't have to worry about that being because there was a, you know, sort of stereotype based on our race. And so it's not to suggest that those of us who are white have easy lives or that we're all wealthy, we have it made. It's to say that there are certain things that the dominant group in any category doesn't have to think about. And I think unless we think about those things, unless we make ourselves discuss them and think about them, we oftentimes end up contributing to injustice just by virtue of our own blindness and our own indifference.
Do you ever get tired of trying to find ways to bring this up?
Well, you know, unfortunately, it's so easy because there's so many things.
It seems
that
like
remind
history
us.
Is overtaking it sometimes. Like yeah. You get an episode of which discrimination is so visible.
Yeah.
As Katrina, for instance.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think. Well, you know, what's funny or not funny? What's interesting about Katrina is that initially, I think, there was a certain degree of recognition of the race and class injustice that was associated with the governmental response and even the private sector response on the part of all parties, by the way, both political parties, white political leaders and black leaders like the mayor of New Orleans, all of whom just you know, fumbled this ball terribly. But within a couple of months, what was horrible was the University of Chicago did a survey of white Americans where they asked, do you think that the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, teaches us anything about race in America. And although almost all black folks said yes, only 38% of white Americans answered yes. So it was as if all of a sudden we'd been awake for a second, then we went back to sleep and decided that, no, it really doesn't tell us anything that 50,000 people were trapped in the Superdome and the Convention Center and they were almost all black and brown. It really doesn't tell us anything that the government told the Red Cross not to come in and save people, that they actually had a relief blockade on the city. That doesn't tell us anything. The fact that they didn't do that in the wider parts of Mississippi that were hit, that doesn't mean anything. The fact that the New Orleans school city public school buses were used in a neighboring parish to get 7,000 white folks out of St. Bernard Parish and get them out of town, while black folks who actually paid for those buses sat in the convention center in the Superdome, that didn't even make the news. Now, I've got the satellite photographs that show the buses headed for the pier to pick up these white folks. The news won't cover it. That doesn't tell us anything, you know? And so I think we went back to sleep just as soon as we had begun to look at it.
Oh, wow. You know, they tried to have a reunion of the people that were in the Superdome, and nobody showed up.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
they asked Steve Piku, who studies trauma, social trauma. He's a sociologist, and he worked up here. He's well known up in Alaska because of his work with the survivors of the Exxon Valdez oil spill.
Yeah.
He said, why did this go wrong? He said, well, they probably aren't there anymore. They're probably gone. They're either dead or they're gone someplace else.
Right. Well, and they're not going to come back
Some are here. We've got Cajuns up here that are out of that diaspora.
You know, folks are not going to go back for a reunion unless you can also ensure that they're going to get the mental health care services that they've been denied, the physical health care services, the housing opportunity. Right now in New Orleans, there's, you know, 50,000 abandoned homes. They're not being rehabilitated by the city. Landlords are not being required to fix them up. You've got an increase in the homelessness population of between 10 and 15,000 people. No mental health care infrastructure. 50,000 people diagnosed with post-traumatic stress can't get care. And yet we hear all these stories on every major network about how New Orleans is bouncing back. Well, you know, white New Orleans is bouncing back and affluent New Orleans is bouncing back. And for some folks, it's working. But for an awful lot of folks, and disproportionately folks of color, they've been forgotten by Democrats and Republicans alike, by both presidential administrations. And it's shameful.
So it kind of makes your point. So the question is, if even such a massive wake-up call as that doesn't get the word through, how does the word get through?
Well, I think that what it teaches us, and this is true about Katrina, it's true about the Gulf oil spill, it's true about 9/11, all these traumas that you and I were talking about before we even came on the air, it shows to me that we're not very good at responding with long-term thinking to short-term crisis. You know, when you have a trauma, it's not usually when you're your best self. You know, and that's true of our personal lives. Something horrible happens in our life. It's usually not when we get analytical. You know, it's usually when we respond in sort of a knee-jerk way, and often not a positive one. And we as a country aren't very good at responding to crisis unless there's somebody to go bomb, you know, and then we're pretty quick and good at that, I suppose. But you know, not to be cynical, but what I think is required is we've got to have a much longer term strategy and realize that when it comes to racism, when it comes to economic injustice, any kind of injustice, it's not a short-term thing. It's not a sprint. It's a marathon kind of race. And so we've got to be very deliberate about setting policies and practices and procedures in place that allow us to challenge these things in criminal justice, in housing, employment, schools, et cetera, the healthcare delivery system, instead of waiting for some big thing to blow up. You know, the big thing that blows up is easier to get your head around because it's obvious, but often it's the more subtle things that are going on. You know, right now, there are 2 to 3 million cases of housing discrimination against people of color in the U.S. every year. But who knows anything about that? The only time you'll hear about that is if there's a blatant case where a landlord, you know, violently attacks his renters or something. Well, that's the tip of the iceberg. You know, you'll have a big police brutality case that might have racial implications. You'll hear about that. Meanwhile, though, the evidence says that black and Latino males, for instance, are being pulled over by police and searched at 2 times the rate of whites, even though whites are 4 times more likely to have drugs in our car when we're searched, 4 times more likely to have illegal contraband. Now, that's data that's not even going to make the news. You have
Totally didn't know that.
No, and it's Justice Department data. You know that they search black and brown folks far more often. They find stuff on white folks far more often, but they keep searching the black and brown folks. So, you know, it's completely overlooked. The fact that you know, Native Alaskans, you know, have 3 times the poverty rate, and indigenous people generally in the Americas have 3 times the poverty rate of whites, is consistently sort of written off as just some type of cultural pathology or, you know, these are folks who just don't work as hard or try as hard. That is not challenged in the mainstream media. So both the evidence of racial inequity, the statistical data, but also the stories that give it weight and put meat on the bones of that data are just overlooked unless there's a major crisis. If there's a hate crime, we'll pay attention to it. But if tens of thousands of people of color, Black, Latino, Indigenous people, die every year because of inadequate health care, die every year because of excess hypertension, die every year because of unequal medical care, that doesn't make the news. And yet the CDC says literally tens of thousands of people of color die each year because of those things.
Well, here in Alaska, we have a number of different races and cultures. Mm. And, you know, they're different. Yeah. You know, the Asian population is different. Pacific Island population is different. It's actually kind of a blessing to have so many different cultures in one place. Or it could be.
Yeah.
But if you look at, you know, how Alaska was settled by the white culture, you know, it's just as brutal as anywhere else in the United States. The indigenous people were pretty well treated in a genocidal way. The ones that the white people could get to. Some of them were way back to where nobody could get to them.
Yeah, yeah.
And that still is, that's still here. That impulse is still going on. But you don't, you know, what with the mainstream culture continually importing more people for the jobs and whatnot, it's like not even seen. It's not even realized that there's a continuum, right from, you know, the enslavement of the Aleuts,
right.
Through the boarding schools where kids were ripped out of their culture and a whole generation was sent off to where all their language and culture was taken away from them.
Well, you know,
and now we have a situation where the Alaska Federation of Natives is you know, the younger generation is taking over there, and they see this and they're calling it racism. Yeah. You know, their parents didn't, whether they were too polite or whatnot, but the younger ones are.
Yeah. You know, I think you make a good point, and the invisibility to non-Indigenous people of Indigenous people and their struggles is, I think, nowhere better sort of evidence than in this, what I consider really absurd debate going on about whether or not a Muslim cultural center should be built two blocks away from so-called Ground Zero in New York. And everybody says, well, you know, you can't do that. It's Ground Zero. It's hallowed ground. But the truth is, you know, there's not a square foot of land in this continent that isn't Ground Zero for somebody. You know, I live in Nashville, Tennessee. That's Ground Zero for Cherokee, Chickasaw, Choctaw, and Creek, people who were run out by Andrew Jackson, whose home is 15 minutes from my home, who plotted and helped to plot the genocide of those individuals. That's Ground Zero for them. But do we say, well, you can't build a Christian church there because, you know, Christianity was used to justify that slaughter? Do we say we can't have tours at Andrew Jackson's home, the Hermitage, because after all, he was the architect of that? No, we don't say that. Nor would that be, you know, necessarily the right thing to say. The point is, we forget that Ground Zero for Native peoples is the entire continent that we now call North America. It is, and for that matter, South America, and for that matter, most of the world's indigenous people everywhere have been run out by other people and have been conquered and killed by other people. So we can't make our Ground Zero, the one that we think is more important, somewhat hallowed ground, and then act as if the rest of it we can do and say and live as we please. We have to remember that all of these pains are significant, and the fact that we have the luxury of forgetting the pain and the injury done to others is just more evidence of privilege.
Wow. The luxury of forgetting. We're talking with Tim Wise. He's author of White Like Me, also Colorblind, and other books, which we will probably get into discussing as the program continues. At this point, I want to bring in an Alaskan. Jack DeYoung is the author of Boomtown Boy, Coming of Age on Alaska's Lost Frontier. And he joins us by telephone from Washington State, where he now lives. But Jack is known to many Alaskans because he wrote for the Newsminer for a long time. And he's just kind of somebody that a lot of people remember. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Jack.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
And I understand you got a book signing for this new book that is out, Boomtown Boy, that is coming up in Anchorage, and then you also get to go to Fairbanks on your trip tomorrow.
Yes, I'll be signing the book at Barnes & Noble tomorrow night, beginning at 6 o'clock. And that will last for a couple of hours, and then there are a bunch of Anchorage writers who want to show me where the good beer is, so I'll go to that.
Good for you. And then to Fairbanks in a historical lecture.
Well, yeah, that simply amounts to talking about being a college editor during the McCarthy era and how that bounced back on me and my co-editor, Alfred Baumeister, and afterwards a long famous academic. And it was kind of fun now that we look back on it. It wasn't much fun at the time.
I don't reckon, but I want to take you back to that that era when you were just a kid there in Fairbanks before that stuff happened, because you treat that in your book. Boomtown Boy is perhaps wisely confined to an early part of your life, to when you're really just a kid. And you talk about the Fairbanks that you were born into as a Gold Rush Fairbanks, and then the Fairbanks that you grew up in, which was a World War II Fairbanks, and that's the Boomtown. And basically, your family, had some roots in the Gold Rush, and you got to, as you put it in the book yourself, you got to live through an actual time warp, because when the World War II came in, it took a Gold Rush thing, something that was of the deep past, and all of a sudden brought it up to the present. So you really got to see some of these attitudes toward Alaska Natives that we've just begun talking about with Tim Wise here, right there in the flesh. And you described some of that in your book, and that's why I wanted to have you on. Did anybody in your family think of themselves as racist, your family or your companions and so forth?
First, I want to say that we had only a couple of black people in the town I grew up in at the beginning. So there was no obvious black prejudice because there were no blacks to be prejudiced against. But there was obvious prejudice, of course, I didn't recognize it at the time as a kid, against natives. My parents, my mother particularly, warned me against, playing with natives because natives are dirty. They have diseases. Well, of course, most of my schoolmates, white, were also dirty and had diseases. And God knows I had my diseases. We were a relatively poor family. The other thing was that we made fun of natives in school because they had these screwy names, many of them, like Joe Joseph and Sally and so forth. These are the kind of names that missionaries and teachers gave to them because their native names were unpronounceable. And these became names which got onto documents, Social Security cards, that kind of thing. So we made fun of them, and of course, as I detail in the book, I got into fights with them, and I learned the hard way that a native kid could fight just as well, if not better, than I did. But most of them, of course, dropped out of school because they had very little money. And it was the usual thing. If you had 10 bucks, you made fun of somebody who had no dollars. And, of course, in my case, we had the 10 bucks, and the native families had no money. So it gave me something to make fun of. But my father taught me otherwise. My father was perhaps the most unprejudiced, racially prejudiced person I've ever really met. And because his family was intermarried, he was of German-Dutch descent, but that family was intermarried with many people of Jewish backgrounds. So there was no Jewish prejudice in that group. And he tried to help native families when we could supply them with some food or some help of some sort. But the general rule was that native kids got hell in school. And, of course, if you're going to spend first 12 years of your life getting hell, that's not much fun. You may drop out.
It's interesting about your dad because he worked in Northern Commercial, and didn't he actually do some of the fur buying?
Yes, he was a fur buyer, and he had many, many Native friends because they would bring their furs in to a store, and there was a ritual. I won't go through it. But suffice to say, they considered him a fair, equitable man. He didn't try to screw them over. And so he knew them. We had as kids this wonderful Native-made clothing that my dad would buy. He'd order it ahead of time, and my mother would take me out to the Native woman, and we'd get sized up and so on. Unfortunately, the Fairbanks school system felt that, say, moccasins were bad for your feet, so we couldn't wear those in school. And people made fun of my wearing, for instance, a moose hide jacket. And that got me into fights, too, with whoever.
Yeah, Jack, we'll go into this the next time we have you on. But, I mean, fighting was not unknown to you. It seemed to me that your set was fighting all the time.
Well, I had the book. He gave me a call the other day from somebody I hadn't seen in 60 years. He said, "Do you remember me?" And I said, "Well, I sure remember your left hook."
Yeah. So in the Fairbanks that you were growing up in, I don't know if you see it or if you feel it, but it struck me that if Anchorage is maybe racist, Fairbanks is definitely racist. I mean, maybe that's just the prejudice of an Anchorage person, but you lived in that town for many years. Did you feel that Alaska Natives were being discriminated against in Fairbanks?
Well, I thought they were being discriminated against everywhere, particularly when I was an adult and was out into the villages as a reporter. For instance, I could tell you that they were being discriminated against.
Yes.
Before statehood and before the Alaska Native Claims Act, believe me, they were really getting the shaft. And they were getting it economically. They were getting it. They were being ignored, even when the oil money came in. It took suits to get schools and so forth into the Native villages, which were commonplace in the white towns.
Yeah, I think we need reminders of these. I mean, we're talking in our very definitely, living memory times. I mean, even in the 70s, really.
Well, for instance, in the schools, out in the villages, most of the teachers were missionaries. And many of those little villages, there'd be, 100 people in them, and there'd be 10 denominations in the village, and most of these missionaries teaching in the schools. And so a lot of Native people started going to all of these churches because they felt that if they didn't, that the teachers would discriminate in grades and so forth against their children. And I don't know that's true, but I have a hunch that it probably was.
Tim Wise, would you say that rings true?
Oh, absolutely. I think everything that Jack is saying rings very, very true.
Yeah. I mean, this business about parental concern, that a parent of color has a whole other concern for their children that a white person and in their white privileged setting can't even conceive of.
Well, I tell a story about that actually in White Like Me that sometimes it gets misunderstood. But when I was a kid and I grew up in Nashville and was actually, in public schools from 74 to 86. And in 74, 75 was the first school year that the elementary schools had been fully integrated in Nashville, just to put in perspective how long it took for Brown v. Board to actually be implemented. And one of the stories that I tell, my parents who were, these white liberal Southerners, there are some of those for those who were shocked to hear that phrase combined, made it very clear that I was not to be the target of corporal punishment. Corporal punishment, spanking kids in school was still very much allowed, is still in the South and certainly in Tennessee. But, you know, I was my parents had a letter on file. You can't touch our kid. And of course, you know, a ton of research now lets us know that corporal punishment doesn't work. It's not an effective means of discipline. But at the time, you know, what was interesting was it seemed like the only parents who were saying that were the white parents. And the black parents and the black kids were, you know, getting corporal punishment all the time. And some people thought that was because the black parents were okay with it. But in fact, that wasn't it. The difference was those black parents, when you'd speak with them as adults, when I would talk later in workshops and conversations with African-American families, they would, or any families of color, they would talk about the fact they didn't want the teachers to lay their hands on their kids. They didn't want the principals to lay the hands on their kids. But there was this fear.
Oh, but they didn't put a letter in, though.
But they didn't put a letter. And the reason was that they didn't feel that they had the entitlement or the power to say to that administrator, you're not going to do this. They felt disempowered relative to the power structure, whereas my parents at the age of, you know, 26 years old or whatever, were more than willing to say, you're not going to do it. And they also were afraid. There was a real fear that if their kids, particularly if they had male kids, that if they did not get strict discipline in that school, that they were going to be out of control 10 years later and a cop might, you know, take them out. Then, in other words, they didn't want corporal punishment, but they were so afraid that if their children were not controlled for even the least little acting up, which frankly was nowhere near what us white kids were doing in the schools, that somehow later on they'd be out of control and might end up dead as a result of it. That's a real fear that parents of color, I mean, I talk to women of color who say that, you know, when their kids would turn 16 and they would drive for the first time, they were very clear. If you get stopped by an officer, you keep your hands on the wheel at 10 and 2. You don't reach for your glove compartment to look for the registration. You don't reach for your license until they ask you. And then you ask, can I reach for the glove? And that's the kind of thing my mom never said to me. When you drive, watch out, because they might shoot you if you make a false move. The assumption was they wouldn't in my case. You know,
it's a life or death, of life or death. The stakes are really high. Mm-hmm. And sassing is a can be a hanging offense almost.
Right. And I talk back to officers regularly. I mean, I had the level of privilege that allowed me when I would get pulled over to just look at a cop and say, you know, why'd you pull me over? I didn't do anything. And I told black friends of mine that story and they looked at me incredulous, like, hey, what? You know, why don't you have bruises? Why aren't you in the hospital? And then they went, oh yeah, wait, it's because you're white, you know?
Oh, yeah, wait.
I figured it out, you know?
Jack DeYoung, the Fairbanks that you grew up in, how different is it from the Fairbanks of now?
Well, I hate to generalize for the moment. I haven't lived there for 20 years, you know, full time. I go back to visit. The one thing I do notice, of course, is that there's no longer a really tight downtown like there was when I was a kid. And in those days, the common drunks would often just sprawl on the sidewalk, and the cops would rouse the natives if they could, and they leave the white guys there if they weren't creating any commotion. A little racial choice.
Yeah.
But that kind of thing is not evident anymore because everything's spread out all over God's creation up there compared to the town I lived in.
Well, tell me, what do you think accounted for your dad's difference in matters of prejudice? You called him the most unprejudiced person I could think of. Why was that? Where did he get those values?
Well, I have no idea about his upbringing because I was born late in his life and all of his parents were dead. But I do know, for instance, he sailed before the mast with his father, an able-bodied sailor, as a boy, you know, an adolescent. And he also worked in the Nooshigak tanneries, where lots of Chinese people were imported for the rotten jobs, really rotten jobs in those tanneries, I assure you. And, of course, there was this Jewish intermarriage. Two of his sisters married Jewish brothers who belonged to a very large Jewish family in San Francisco and in Portland, and as a matter of fact, in Oregon. So he had those kind of contacts. But he had the sense of you shouldn't pretend to be better than other people because basically you're not. This is one of the lessons that he was not a preacher, but it was, you know, it kind of came across. Don't get uppity toward other people. Everybody's got a problem. Everybody's struggling. Everybody's trying to stay alive. And we were among the, we weren't broke poor, but we were, you know, what I used to call an oatmeal eating family. It ate a lot of oatmeal.
Yeah.
And so there was that. And he was also a man who liked, had a lot of humor, and he liked to use it. But it was always pleasant about it. And so we would go out when I was a kid to visit friends, they white and native. And, we'd go, for instance, visit what was left of the Salcher, of the Salchakut Indians, who had been decimated by disease, living 40 miles south of Fairbanks. And all of the white, all of the young people had to leave because a cash economy had been shoved on them, and you couldn't make any cash out there except by trapping. Well, you know, you can only trap so much. So they had a hard time, and finally it was just a bunch of old folks. I was a boy, you know, anywhere from 6 to 10. I wasn't capable of quite understanding the full extent of what my eyes were taking in, but basically looking at a culture that died or was nearly dead. The last Salchakut speaker died just a couple of years ago. And that's it. They're over. They're gone. They're history in the real sense of the word.
Jack DeYoung, I want to thank you so much for being with us, and I hope that the fabulous weather that we're having up here greets you when you come in tomorrow afternoon.
This is causing me problems. Should I stuff a parka in my duffel or not?
Well, you know, it's Alaska.
No, that's the problem. Yeah. Thank you very much, and I enjoy the program, and I particularly agree with Tim, your guest. He's got that right on the noggin, as far as I'm concerned.
Right on the noggin. All right. Well, we'll be back with more of Tim Wise and White Like Me as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a pre-existing medical condition, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the new temporary federal insurance program being administered by ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. The program is for those with qualifying pre-existing conditions and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months. Talk to an independent insurance broker or go online to ACHIA.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed.
It's Talk of Alaska, and it is statewide all over the state, and we're talking about racism. It's always something that I have hesitated to broach on this program because I didn't know how to really get a handle on it to have a constructive discussion. But it needs to be talked about. You got to start someplace, and one guy that's figured out where to start it is Tim Wise. He is our guest here, and he is here with the Healing Racism Movement that was set up in Anchorage. This by email from Metlakatla, Alaska's only Indian reservation, by the way. Mm. It was during those long, lonely years that my hunger for the freedom of my own people became a hunger for the freedom of all people, white and black. I knew as well as I knew anything that the oppressor must be liberated just as surely as the oppressed. A man who takes away another man's freedom is a prisoner of hatred. He is locked behind the bars of prejudice and narrow-mindedness. I am not truly free if I am taking away someone else's freedom just as surely as I am not free when my freedom is taken from me. The oppressed and the oppressor alike are robbed of their humanity. All that from Nelson Mandela, Long Road to Freedom. A wonderful book, says Louise. Everyone should read. Love your show. Keep up the good work. But more on the industrialization of food, please. They can't get enough of that one right now. Well, you know, you're gonna step right into something pretty strange in terms of modern media tomorrow morning when you go on the Bob and Mark show.
Right.
We had this program called Cash for Clunkers, Clunker Cars.
Right.
And it was a natural sort of thing for shock jocks to be talking about, I suppose, you know, because who doesn't want to make money off of their dead car?
Sure.
But for some reason, somebody misspoke and it came out Cash for Clinkets.
Right.
Well, there are so many different dimensions of racism to this that I don't even know where to start.
Right.
But two of the main ones are, first, there's a mispronunciation. Clunker is a k sound, and clinket is a sound that you're only able to make if you learn to speak the language.
Right.
But it sounds a lot like K.
Yeah.
But it's not. It's T.
Right.
And
right.
Second, these were people that were enslaved and resisted enslavement. And so some people resented that. And the disc jockeys who did this are essentially professional louts. In other words, this is their job to act like louts, whether they are louts or not, because that's who is the target audience that's going to buy the kind of junk that their advertisers are selling.
Sure. Well, you know, the whole sort of morning zoo, morning drive time radio thing, the whole shtick. And of course, that's where Glenn Beck got his start. So that's always an interesting thing to point out. And he used to do these really racially insensitive routines as well, where he would target Asian folks and he would put on these mock accents of black folks. And
he had his buddy there.
Yeah, his sidekick.
Was black, so.
Yeah, it made it okay. Right. You know, well, Rush Limbaugh's soundboard guy is black too, but that doesn't mean a lot. You know, so the thing about Bob and Mark, and like you said, I'll get to meet them tomorrow. On the one hand, you know, the routine that they gave voice to on the show is very typical of the genre. But what is atypical, and I do want to say that this is an important lesson, is that when the indigenous community and the folks here who are challenging racism really brought to their attention and to the station's attention the hurt and the pain and the injury associated with doing that routine, unlike most folks, I think, in that genre, they did. Not only did they apologize, and I mean a real apology, not the kind that a lot of folks say, which is, oh, I'm sorry you were offended, you know, which is not an apology at all. They offered real contrition. And in fact, when they were interviewed, my understanding is during a press conference, they were offering, you know, a real depth of analysis as to why what they had done was wrong. So what it shows to me is that if you approach people and instead of simply just sort of yelling at them about what's happened, sometimes that's appropriate. Look, sometimes you got to just fight fire with fire like that. But there are other times when folks act out of such deep-seated ignorance and deep-seated unawareness of the real injury and the pain of racism, that when it's brought to their attention or when they get to hear the stories of actual indigenous people who can explain why this was so painful, that they have that opportunity for growth. And I think the thing that the Nelson Mandela quote that you read a second ago that was emailed here it speaks to this issue. The thing about racism, the thing about white supremacy as a system of thought and action over the years is that it has distorted the humanity of those of us who are white. It's not only that it harms those who aren't, it injures our humanity too and makes it harder for us to see that pain that is associated with racism. And, you know, Bob and Mark are like most of us, probably very decent human beings who nonetheless do occasionally indecent things. You know, we all do that. We all screw up. And the question is whether or not we're going to be given the opportunity to redeem ourselves and to do the right thing. If we're given that opportunity and we don't take it, that's when there has to be some real accountability and some real action taken. But if we're given that opportunity and we do and we try to reclaim our humanity and speak on behalf of equity and act as allies in the struggle for justice, then that's an important step. And so I'm glad that the challenge was offered to them, and I'm glad that up to now they've responded as they did.
Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. That's 550-8422. That's 550-8422. And Tim Wise is our guest, the author of Colorblind and White Like Me. And I have to bring up this one side note. You said this was very unusual, what happened with Bob and Mark being having come to Jesus moment. Shock jocks.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, there's a precedent even before that in Alaska. And I think this is important for Alaska media consumers to know. You recall Likas, Tom Likas?
Oh, yeah.
Well, he made the mistake of taking a call from Juneau, a woman in Juneau. Mm. And he did as usual, you ignorant slut, you know, you yeah. can't get a date. And all, you know, this kind of stuff that he's known for. Mm. She took him to court.
Oh, really?
He had to come to Alaska to face charges.
I didn't know that. I didn't know. It couldn't happen to a nicer guy, but I didn't know
they don't
that.
Run yeah. the Tom Likas show anymore,
yeah.
as you know.
Right.
Okay?
Right, right. Wow.
And it is possible in this media environment, and they're trying to do it to Glenn Beck right now.
Yeah.
That basically, they've got a large number of Glenn Beck sponsors have been boycotted
right.
into dropping their sponsorship of Glenn Beck.
Yeah.
So you're really left with the hardcore. I mean, if you look at who is putting money into the Glenn Beck show right now, that kind of...
Yeah, it's a bunch of phony gold merchants and ripoff artists is what it appears. Yeah, right.
So it can be done, but it you know, it's that same thing. It takes persistence. You have to really grab hold of it, and you have to not let go.
Right.
And there's some kind of moral strength in that that is difficult, it seems, to muster up.
Well, it is, and I think it's because, you know, people are afraid, I think, and folks of color, obviously, can be afraid to challenge racism because they can be afraid of backlash. They can be afraid of being dismissed as being hypersensitive, et cetera, being misunderstood, being ignored. White folks are often afraid to interrupt it when we see it, even amongst our own friends or family, because it's that fear of coming to realize that maybe your friends and your family are so different than you thought. And we don't want to face that. We don't want to face that people we care about and love may in fact have these biases, and that maybe, what does that mean? It means probably we've got some of it too. And then,
and then
we don't want to acknowledge that it's in us. So we turn away from it, or we're afraid of losing friends or alienating family. James Baldwin talked about it as the fear of being turned away from the welcome table of white society. I think we've got to get over that. You know, life is way too short to sit and worry about, how is someone going to perceive me if I stand up and do the right thing? You know, you have a very short time on this earth, shorter than most of us know and would hope for. And it seems to me it's far too short to get worried about the cost of doing the right thing. You know, we need to be doing the right thing whenever possible. I know it's frightening. We don't always do it. We drop the ball, but we have to pick it back up again.
Yeah, and I think you can see it right now when people are talking about Katrina, which people do from time to time, to say, it's important to raise some of the points that you raised early in the program.
Yeah.
No, actually, things aren't all right. Things are all right for some of the white folks.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it. I mean, and I think, you know, if we really care about one another, and if we really intend to ever get to the point where we are even a remotely equitable society, we don't have the luxury of watching as a city like New Orleans is virtually wiped off the map and then rebuilt in a very different way. And in some ways, you know, we had some opportunities to rebuild it in a way, and still do, in a way that's more equitable. But that's not what's been going on so far. And to learn lessons, even lessons out of 9/11. Again, what lessons did we learn? Well, we didn't seem to learn a lot, because the level of animosity toward Muslim folks, the level of animosity toward Arab folks and Arab American folks has not, we haven't attempted, at least so far as I've seen, to really reach out and do the kind of ecumenical work we need to be doing to lessen the level of hatred around the world, whether it's toward us or us toward others. Instead, we do more that sort of fuels that fire. We have idiots that are running around, you know, talking about burning the Quran, and we have soldiers who are saying, well, thanks a lot. You know, it's very easy for you to burn the Quran when I've got to worry about the fact that all that does is put us at risk. But people are so bought into their religious biases, their regional biases, their racial biases, that they put their own needs above the needs of equity and justice and fairness for all. And I think it's one of those things that we as a nation don't think is an issue anymore. But I think if you watch TV for more than a week or listen to radio, read the news, it's pretty obvious. This is one of those themes that keeps coming up over and over again.
Robert joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Tim Wise, Robert.
Hello, Mr. Wise. I'm so glad that you're here in Alaska with us. And you're going to, I understand, talk tonight at the Williamson Auditorium at 7:30.
Yes.
A talk that's open to the public and free. And I just wanted to testify as an older white male that I'm full of prejudice. Mm. And I'd never deny that I behave in a racist manner at times. And I think conversation starts with that. When, if we want to have a conversation on race, we have to start by owning our own stuff.
Yeah.
And one way to do it is go to that, implicit.harvard.edu,
sure,
where
sure.
they have the tests on all kinds of prejudice,
mm-hmm.
And the one that is on race says, this test requires the ability to distinguish faces of European and African origin. It indicates that most Americans have an automatic preference for white over black.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that kind of prejudice that leads to unconscious racism and institutional racism, which I think are the two worst factors, at least among my community of relatively enlightened, educated, and civilized people. But we just don't know to what degree we're enmeshed in this racist society and its attitudes without even knowing it. And as long as we deny it, we don't make any progress. But as soon as we admit it, we find there are people of color willing to talk with us and willing to help us, willing to share their stories and let us share ours, and discover why these things are there and how to change it.
Right. Absolutely. And one of the points I try to make in my work is that once we, and all the research says this, so the bad news is, as you pointed out, the overwhelming majority of folks have these implicit biases, these subconscious biases. That's the bad news. The good news is that when you are aware of them, when you're willing to own them, put them in the middle of the room and face them, the evidence says that we then can check our behavior. You know, you can check your behavior if you're willing to look at the thing that's causing it. What you can't do is check your behavior when you're ignoring the fact that the impulse is there. You know, advertising works, as I like to say. And that's why corporations spend billions to sell us toothpaste and toilet paper and Big Macs and all of this stuff. And it works. That's why they spend the money. Well, if we can be convinced that we need X type of toothpaste as opposed to Y, and A type of toilet paper as opposed to B, obviously, given years of conditioning with racial stereotypes and biases, we're going to be sold on that too. All we can do is resist it and challenge it and fight back, but we can't act like it's not there.
We really need that national conversation on race, and we need to be honest about it. And the great upside is when people are willing to admit their biases, their prejudices, and their racist attitudes and behaviors, they find there are a lot of people willing to listen to them and embrace them and say, yeah, we know what you're talking about, and let's figure out some ways to get better.
Yes, indeed.
Robert, thanks for your call from Anchorage.
Oh, yeah.
It's Talk of Alaska, 1-800-478-8255, local call in Anchorage, 550-8422, email talk@APRN.org, and our guest is Tim Wise. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station.
If you smoke, odds are you want to quit. And if you want to quit, you're probably finding it tough to do. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line can help. The average smoker tries 10 times before they quit for good. You can increase your chances by calling the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line. A trained quit coach is waiting for your call. Give it a shot. It's free and it works. Call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line.
Well, of course, if you don't know the title of Tim Wise's book, White Like Me, is a takeoff on a fairly famous bestseller, Black Like Me. Diane writes by email, says, hey, I read Black Like Me. I didn't know about this other one, but by golly, I'm going to go out and get it. Tim Wise, what's your attitude towards Black Like Me? Which is, I guess I'll just give the background real quick. This is a white guy who writes about his experience because he actually took chemicals to make his own skin dark, and then he found himself discriminated against. He wrote about it.
Right. Well, you know, when Black Like Me was written, which was 1950, he did the research in 59 and wrote it in 60. John Howard Griffin took this medicine called Sorlin to become black for the summer and go through the Jim Crow South and write about it. And on the one hand, it was incredibly courageous and brave, and certainly not something that most white journalists or writers would have wanted to do. On the other hand, I always found it a little inadequate for me, because on the one hand, it's a very good book, and in 1960, I'm sure sure it was a revelation for a lot of white folks. Of course, the irony of that is that black people, real black people, had been writing that book or the equivalent of that book forever, and nobody seemed to want to care. All of a sudden, a white guy takes drugs for the summer, writes the same book, and white America goes, "Oh my God, look how hard it is to be black. I had no idea."
Drugs.
Right. You know, and it becomes a learning opportunity. Now, on the one hand, I'm grateful he did it. On the other hand, I remember reading it in high school, and there was even part of me then that thought, well, that's interesting, and I can sort of get a secondhand, vicarious look at the black experience through that. But it seemed to me there was this piece which was missing, which was, what does it mean to be white in a white-dominated society? What does it mean to actually have those advantages, not just the disadvantages? And that was the piece that I felt by 2005, when I wrote White Like Me, that we were prepared to explore, that we didn't just have to know about, stand in the other guy's shoes. We also got to figure out what shoes we're in right now. And I think if we get clear on that, just like if men get clear on what it means to be men in a male-dominated society, we get some insight into what it means not to be a man, you know, into what it means to be a woman. If folks with money would get clear on what it means that they have money, they'll have a better sense of what it means to go without. You know, sometimes you can't just look at the other person's story. You got to get clear on your own.
I have to say that you could actually make a collection of White Like Me's. Apparently, I have an early edition. This is the, right. I guess you'd call it the 9/11 edition. Then you have a Katrina edition. Now you're thinking about having an Obama edition. You cannot let this book go.
Right.
You keep having more to say about
this.
Well,
the thing is, this is an evolving story, and it's one of those things where I'm lucky to have a publisher that lets me update and change things. I realized after I wrote, the first version came out in January of 05. And of course, 8 months later was Katrina. And then I did a new version in 07 that had an epilogue on Katrina, because I felt like that was an example of to really talk about white privilege and racism again. And of course, then in 08, with the election of President Obama, lots of white folks in particular, and some people of color, but mostly white folks, are saying, well, see, that's it. No more white privilege, no more racism, black guys president, it's over. And of course, as I say in the last two books I've written, Between Barack and a Hard Place and Colorblind, that argument makes no more sense than to say that there's no more sexism in Pakistan after 1988 because Benazir Bhutto was elected and she was a woman, obviously. Just because of individual success by a marginalized group member doesn't mean the system has changed. But I feel like I need to put that into White Like Me because it's a book that is taught at hundreds of college campuses. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of people's introduction to the issues of privilege and racism. And I feel like unless I have a preface that talks about white privilege in the age of Obama, people will say, well, this is old. This doesn't count anymore. So I'll keep up dating it. And luckily, unlike John Howard Griffin in the publishing business in the 60s, the industry now allows for that kind of thing. And so I'm grateful to be able to do that.
Natasha joins the program from Kodiak. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Natasha.
Thank you.
How you doing?
I'm good, thank you. I really am enjoying this show that you guys are having today.
Well, thank you. You want to say a few words to Tim here?
Yeah, I just wanted to bring up something that's been going on here in Kodiak. There was a lawsuit over some land ownership in the last that was settled a couple of years ago in the U.S. Supreme Court, and one of the parties involved is Lesnoy Corporation, which is Alaska Native corporation, and the land I'm not sure the exact specifics of the lawsuit itself, but I believe it involves some people that had squatted on some land and had assumed ownership, and they challenged the fact that the Lesnoy Corporation was indeed an Alaska Native corporation under INCSA. And the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that yes, they were, and they did have, they were entitled to that land. Recently, I've been exposed to different individuals that have printed bumper stickers and stickers and T-shirts that have got a red circle with a line through it over the name of Lesnoy. And I believe that the motivation behind it is because a lot of the land is located along the road system here in Kodiak and is premium for camping and people using ATVs and recreational use. And because it has been declared as private property, there's people that are upset because they're no longer allowed free reign on.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up. This is did you ever hear a treaty beer? Same deal.
No.
Spearfishing controversy. Oh, yeah. Natives are allowed to spearfish and we aren't. Oh, yeah, we can't have that. Same deal. And all this, bumper stickers and all that. Sounds like kind of the same thing, Natasha.
Yeah, it's a very it's a very interesting case because, you know, it's people who normally will scream and yell about their own private property rights, you know. But when it's somebody else, when it's in this case, indigenous peoples, then all of a sudden, wait a minute, now we want to use that land, you know. So I think that is a good example, too, of sort of a privileged or entitled mindset. What we forget with indigenous peoples, whether it's in Alaska or in the mainland, is that these are treaty treaty obligations. These are sovereign entities, at least partially sovereign. And this is like no different than when we have agreements with other nations. You don't get to just say, well, you know, we get to do whatever we want with the land that we took. You know, that's really not the way it works. And I think we sometimes forget the sovereignty issues that are involved.
Yeah. And seems to me that it's pretty divisive in the community. There's people that I've known, I've lived here most of my life, and that they're offended, and they are, you know, very anti-Lesna, anti-Native Corporation, and, you know, are crying out loud from the, you know, tops of buildings. And it seems there's been very few people who are willing to stand up and say, you know, these people were deemed by the United States Supreme Court to have a right to that land. And how can you question that? And that, you know, it's pretty divisive here.
Yeah. I think we just got a couple of minutes. I want to go into this business of a poster that I saw, which has Obama with the Joker face. Mm. What's going on with that?
Well, gosh, you know, I mean, the symbolism.
I guess I'll cut to the chase here.
Yeah.
I don't know a single person of color that I've talked to who has not agreed with me when I said, it seems to me there's some racism behind this Tea Party thing.
Yeah.
And they all say, most of them say exactly the same thing. You'll never get them to see it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that, you know, some of it's blatant, and much more so than the Joker. I mean, you know, some of the posters of Obama with the bone through his nose dressed like the African witch doctor, or pictures of the White House lawn covered in watermelons and that kind of stuff. But I mean, I think the bigger issue with the Tea Party, it's not just the blatant stuff. And I'm not suggesting everyone involved in that movement is racist. But I will say that when you start running around older white folks saying, I want my country back, there is an instinctive reaction that I think we better understand, folks of color, and even myself, having like, wait a minute, I remember what your country was. You know, I remember the country that you're remembering was not a great place for everyone. So even though you may not mean it that way, you may not mean, oh, I want to go back to those days in terms of segregation or whatever else, understand how that's read. Understand what you're saying is, I'm losing my country. Well, the country that you're losing needed to be lost. You know, the country of profound and institutionalized inequity needed to go away. If you don't like what it's being replaced with, we can have that conversation. But don't talk about going back to those days, because for millions of people, they weren't good.
Wow. Well, you know what? You just used up all the time.
Uh-oh.
Tim Wise, thank you so very much for being with us.
You bet.
Tim gives a public lecture, as we heard just a few moments ago, at the University of Alaska tonight, right?
Yes, tonight at 7:30.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
I'm sure we'll be back to this subject in a future Talk of Alaska. Next week, we start on our political shows again. It's been so nice not to talk politics for a little while. Scott McAdams will be our guest. Dave Waldron on the controls. Oh, Connie Huff on the phones. And Pat Yak. I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. The Federal Aviation Administration sets rules for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, and when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll free at 1-866-357-4704. This message is sponsored by the FAA. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.